Welcome to the Simply His Coffee Shop. So today is week three in a four-week series. Again, if you missed the last 2 weeks, you really need to go back and watch those shows. They were incredible shows. We're talking about the new book by Tom Horn, Donna Howell, and Allie Anderson on the mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. And last week we talked about Ruth and how Jesus showed up in Ruth and how important that little bitty book is. But we are going to be moving away from the Old Testament and move into the New Testament and talk about the period between where the Old Testament ends and the New Testament begins. Allie, tell us what that is and what happened in between that phase.
So it's easy in church to go from the last of the Old Testament and flip forward to the first part of Matthew, and you think all you've done is turn the page in time, right. But actually what most people don't realize is that there's a 400-year gap between the last book in the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament.
Okay.
So what we have is this period of time where if you follow culturally what's going on, you start kind of understanding the political and social climate that Jesus was born into.
Okay.
And when you follow some of that, you start to understand why they responded to him the way they did.
Okay.
So first of all, toward the end of the Old Testament, we see what a lot of people refer to as the period of exile. And basically what happened was Babylon overtook the southern kingdom. And they invaded Jerusalem, sacked the temple, and they took all the treasure out of the temple. And then they took a bunch of captive Jews back to Babylon.
Right.
Then Persia came in and conquered, overtook the region, and they let the Jews return to their homeland.
Right.
So if you read them, the last parts of the Old Testament, you know, they're talking about rebuilding the wall. They're talking about rebuilding the temple. What this is a lot of post-exilic Jews who have been allowed to return to their home, and basically everything is in ruins.
Wow. Right.
It's post-slavery. They're still under the reign of these Persians, but they're at least allowed to be in their home rebuilding. This is the wreckage that comes about as our punishment for our idolatry, for turning our back on God. And God allowed us to be taken into this terrible situation, basically to get us back on track with him. And so as they rebuilt and as they put their civilization back together and resumed their way of life, a lot of them went into this legalistic, we'll never let this happen again kind of mindset.
Yeah.
And so through this period of time, then we have the Pharisees. Well, the Pharisees in the beginning, they were not these terrible, judgy, horrible people.
Right.
What they were was they were people that looked at the situation they were in and said, we will never do this again.
Yeah. Right. Trying to bring back the law and order.
Exactly. And so in doing so, they separated from evil and eventually separated from other people. And eventually kind of became these elite, legalistic, religious snobs. But actually, in the beginning, their intentions were very good.
Right.
In the meantime, eventually Rome takes over this area, and Rome was ruthless. If you haven't done any historical studies, and we can talk a little bit about Rome, but Rome was ruthless. And so you see also within the Jewish religious leadership, you see some of the more well-known and prosperous religious leadership within the Jews begin to kind of gain favor with Rome. And they develop this kind of working relationship where everybody understands Rome's in charge. And Rome will wipe you out if you mess with them.
Right.
So Rome was allowing the Jews to practice religious freedom and to keep their customs as long as it never went beyond a certain level of usurpation against Rome. And so these people within power in the religious realms kind of started to hobnob with Rome, and they kind of became a little more elbow rubbing with Rome, and they became the Sanhedrin.
Okay.
So you have these religious leaders who are kind of kissy-kissy with Rome. And then you have these other religious leaders who are saying, this isn't right. We don't like any of this. Legalism, legalism, legalism. Remember what happened last time?
Yeah.
And they're the Pharisees. Then you have the Essenes who kind of withdrew and kept in their own little neck of the woods. And there's a whole different, you know, study about them, which Josh Peck can tell you all about.
Yes.
But a lot of people believe that John the Baptist was an Essene because he kind of came from this strange place in the wilderness, and he was real radical, and he didn't match all the other people. So there were all these different sects of Jews that were kind of building. And these groups of people had 400 years to get set in their ways. And then you had the zealots.
Yeah.
And the zealots were the ones who believed very radically and literally some of the things that are written in a work called the Psalm of Solomon, which I'll read a little bit from in a minute. But basically, these people believed that the promised Messiah was coming to overthrow Rome.
Okay.
How could the Messiah do all these things if Rome was in the way?
Yeah.
So these people were waiting for another Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something that a lot of people don't know about is the ancient city of Sepphoris.
Okay.
So the ancient city of Sepphoris actually isn't referenced in the Bible, but outside the Bible, it is the most historically talked about city in this time and culture, besides Jerusalem.
Okay.
The only place in the Bible that refers directly to Sepphoris, and actually this is even debated by scholars, but it's when Jesus said, a city on a hill cannot be hidden.
Okay.
And when he says the city set on a hill, a lot of people believe that he's referring to Sepphoris because Sepphoris was located up on a hill and it was very strategically located.
Okay.
Let me tell you a little bit about Sepphoris because understanding that will help you understand more about how the people responded to Jesus. So a little bit about the city of Sepphoris. First of all, it was referred to by Josephus as the ornament of Galilee. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who read that think, oh, it means it was pretty. No, it means that it was the place that was the most visible. And it had a very good lookout for all the local areas. So it was a military location.
Okay.
It was very strategic. So it became the place that was indwelt by the Jews. In fact, a lot of scholars believe that Joshua actually settled the city of Sepphoris in the first place, but it's not been conclusively proven.
Okay.
But until about 60 AD, this was a Jewish city. However, because of its great location, guess what? It was under the rule of Rome just like everything else. And so they allowed the Jews to live there peacefully. They could coexist as long as the Jews were doing everything that Rome said to do. So here's a little bit of history about a few events that happened in the city of Sepphoris. In 4 BC, Herod the Great passed away. And a lot of the Jews who were tired of the Roman rule saw this as an opportunity to revolt. In addition, you know, here they've been waiting 400 years for this promised Messiah.
Right.
And they started kind of developing this worldview where they start watching anybody who might lead a revolt. And it's maybe that's the guy. Maybe that's the guy.
Right.
And so what ended up happening is a lot of people, a lot of revolutionaries started trying to rise against Rome. During this time, a man named Judas of the Maccabean Circle actually tried to lead a rebellion. And he was not the only one that did this. Rome's response was to raid the city, burn a large part of it, crucify more than 2,000 of these rebels, and sold more than 30,000 of them into slavery.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Now, this is right around the time that Jesus was born. So think about this. Baby Jesus, he's just been born, and Rome has just gone into the city of Sepphoris, crucified more than 2,000 people, sold 30,000 people into slavery.
God.
These are real people who have disappeared from the population during the time that Jesus is growing up. But what most people don't know is that the city of Sepphoris was within walking distance of where Jesus grew up.
Wow.
So let me talk a little bit about the economy here because this is important too. First of all, it had donkey caravans and extensive trade routes that connected miles and miles of surrounding regions. And the kinds of things they traded, I'm going to read a list. Grains, flax, breads, herbs, fish, wine, ceramics, glassware, goods made of fancy metals, jewelry, clothing made by skilled weavers and tailors, olives, sheep, goat products, basketry, furniture, and perfumes.
Wow.
This is a huge metropolis.
Yeah,
let me tell you about some of the services that were available in this city. Banks, treasuries, armories, court buildings, tax processing facilities, to name only a few, while the list of professions is equally limitless. Masonry, farmer, agricultural work, teaching, money changing, fishing, a variety of metalworking, leatherworking, medical services, actors and entertainers, prison security, and even prostitution.
Wow.
4 miles from where Jesus grew up. So we like to picture
very
this quiet, rural area.
Yeah.
And there's always a mom hanging clothes on the line.
Exactly.
In the Jesus movies.
So quiet.
You know, Jesus grew up right in the crux of this.
Right.
Wow.
So you have this whole multicultural economy happening around him. You have Rome working to keep everybody in line. And they will crucify you and sell your family into slavery if you usurp Rome.
With them.
That's right. The thing is that to understand the cultural climate and the political and religious climate that Jesus was in when he began his ministry. It changes everything. It changes the way that people anticipated him.
Yeah. Right.
We always look back and we think, well, they didn't recognize who they were crucifying. They were waiting for a revolutionary. They were waiting for somebody who could overthrow Rome. Let me read a little bit about the Psalms of Solomon, because this will tell you what the Jews were actually looking for when they were watching for this Messiah. He was going to cleanse all of Jerusalem from the nations that ever had or ever would again seek its destruction. Hmm. Prevent all sinners from inheriting any blessing of wisdom. Humble every sinner's ego and rub out the arrogance of the sinner like a potter's vessel. Obliterate the support of the wicked with an iron rod. Bring to extinction every pagan nation through merely a word of his mouth. Watch as the Gentiles run from the very threat of his appearance. Accept visitations and gifts from the national leaders who will arrive like utterly weakened sons from all over the world who travel just to see his glory, and he will be a king over them taught by God. Now, these are the things that the Jews were watching for.
Where did they come up with that, though? That's a different show.
Okay. But Donna might be able to answer that.
Yeah, really quickly. We read the prophets as typically as it was enlightened through what Jesus did. Mm-hmm. But if your Messiah hadn't shown up yet, then what the prophet said is up to your own individual interpretation. You see, people don't understand that the prophet's words about who the Messiah would be came true for what happened in the New Testament. But there are millennial kingdom verses that don't come to fruition until Revelation, which is still future.
Right.
So a lot of people, they were expecting all of that to happen in one big crunch period. Mm. They don't understand that what we're looking at is a mountain of the duality of, you know, prophetic fulfillment and timing and all of that. That's why people, you're listening to that and you're like, where did they come up with all of this stuff about how he's just going to speak a word and obliterate Gentiles? Like what? Like, exactly. The truth of the matter is that some of that is based on human interpretation, just like everything is today, except it was prior to when the Messiah came. Mm-hmm. And then the Psalm of Solomon was actually continued through multiple generations. So it was one scholar at the time, Jewish scholar, adding on to what his forefathers taught him. It was a train wreck of what they expected.
But they were expecting a warrior.
They were. They were absolutely expecting deliverance from Rome. And so then comes in Jesus, okay? And he's got all the right signs. First of all, he has, you know, John the Baptist going before him. Prepare you the way of the Lord. This is getting ready to happen. And the Magi come and they find him and they say, we've seen his star in the east. There's a lot of stuff that's getting attention. Right. And so those in political authority, first of all, who's this guy? You saw how Herod freaked out when he found out that the Magi were looking for him. Okay, we don't even have time to get into that. Right. But seriously, the political people were getting worried. The religious people were getting more and more concerned because this guy had supernatural power.
Yeah.
He seemed to be able to command things like life and death.
Yeah.
He was able to command demons. So he either is the Lord of the demons or he's God. Well, if he's God, then why aren't you overthrowing Rome?
Right.
Because
you
can't make Rome mad and not overthrow them.
Right.
You remember when you're a kid and you're in class and one kid's making the teacher mad?
Yes.
And you're like, dude, shut up. You're going to get us all in trouble.
Yeah, we're all going to
die. These people remembered. This was their aunts, their uncles, their neighbors.
Yeah, right.
Farmer Bill from down the way.
Yeah.
You know, these were people they knew who disappeared forever because they were sold into slavery. Or they were crucified. So if you're not going to take on Rome and throw them over completely, stop talking.
Yeah.
This is dangerous what you're doing.
Yeah.
We've already seen 16 other would-be messiahs get killed and his whole clan before you.
Yeah.
So this
was
a really, really perilous time for anybody who would actually have the bravery to follow Jesus, for one. He's beginning to really show signs that he might be the Messiah. He's got some supernatural power. He's catching everybody's attention. He's beginning this ministry. But then what does he do? He starts talking about the kingdom of God. And that's a real problem for these people. The kingdom of God was a threat because in this kingdom, the meek and the poor inherited the earth.
Right.
That's a problem for people who are in power and
that's
authority.
That's opposite of
That's right. It exalts the little man and puts down those in power. The least of these is the greatest of these and vice versa, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It broke the religious rules of the institution and elevated the rules of a nobody above the laws of the Jewish temple. By saying, I will heal on the Sabbath and things like that. So he was too countercultural. He wasn't overthrowing Rome, but he also wasn't staying in the system. He was just really kind of a wild card.
Yeah.
And he was really inconvenient, right?
Sure.
He goes in during the Feast of Tabernacles, and they're doing these rituals where they're pouring out this water and they're praying for the Messiah to come. People just think that he's making these random announcements. I am the living water. If you're thirsty, come to me and you'll never thirst again. I am the light of the world. What was happening was these were religious rituals that were taking place in the Jewish temples on the Feast of Tabernacles, where they were praying these prayers and reading scriptures from Malachi and from Isaiah,
yeah,
where they're saying, God, send the light, which they're saying, send the Messiah. You know, there was the scriptures that say the water will flow out into the ends of the earth. You know, these are prophecies talking about the living water in the form of the Messiah. And Jesus goes and stands right in the middle of all of them and says, I'm the light of the world. I'm the living water. Who drinks my water will never thirst again. Well, that was kind of his way of standing right in the middle of all of them and saying, I'm right here. And Rome saw it.
Uh-oh.
And the Sanhedrin saw it.
Whoops.
And you either have to overthrow the system and create a new one that matches the Psalms of Solomon, or you got to go away because you're going to get us all killed.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a scary time. And all of the stuff that Ali's saying, don't forget that when Gamaliel stood in the book of Acts and, you know, they were going to kill the apostles and he was saying, don't touch these men. Mm. And he had this twofold way of looking at it. He said, either these are men of God, in which case you don't want to go against them, or they're another would-be Messiah. We've seen this guy and this guy doing that. And if they're another would-be Messiah, their ministry is going to fizzle out and they're just going to be forgotten anyway. He gave that very advice to the Sanhedrin. Mm. That's that moment in Acts where everything that Ali's talking about, the intertestamental period, is actually verified in the narrative.
Wow.
This is incredibly fascinating stuff. Some of this I haven't even known, and I've grown up in church.
Yeah.
We do need to take a really quick break so you can see how you can get your copies of these books. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Howell, Dr. Thomas Horn, and Ali Anderson team up to bring you their magnum opus. Introducing the brand new 3-volume anthology from Defender Publishing, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. This new collection is being described by those closest to Dr. Thomas Horn as the most important body of legacy work he's ever written. And it's being offered right now in Skywatch TV's largest giveaway of the year. Skywatch TV is proud to announce The Mystery of Jesus Grand Giveaway. Volume 1 of The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation begins in the Old Testament and reveals multiple ways that Jesus made personal appearances on earth called Christophanies prior to his birth through the Virgin Mary, the many links between Mount Sinai, the Day of Pentecost, and the Ascension from astounding but largely hidden revelations in the original Hebrew and Greek, how the words of the prophets regarding the someday Messiah preceded a 400-year season of silence and anticipation that led to disastrously incorrect interpretations of who he would be when he arrived, and so much more. Volume 2 begins in the New Testament and demonstrates what social and political events transpired during the intertestamental period that led to a movement of numerous false messiahs whose military pursuits splintered the Jews into various disjointed sects, each with their own misguided, documented messianic expectations. How extra-biblical and apocryphal books written around the time of Jesus give fresh insight on New Testament characters, their true identity and reputation, and how that affects proper biblical interpretation, the real and largely misunderstood purpose of Christ's ministry years on earth, and why there is an apparent deficit of miraculous manifestations in our day, and we're barely scratching the surface. Then Volume 3 moves directly to the apocalypse, where you'll learn clear-cut, comprehensible explanations behind even the most enigmatic and hard-to-understand symbols in Revelation that anyone can read and understand. How Jesus, present and active in all 66 books of the Bible, makes his grand and final entrance in shining glory to welcome into the New Jerusalem all who receive the free gift of salvation. And we're just getting started. Presented in 3 brand new volumes, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation is organized in a way that is guaranteed to fascinate and boggle the minds of everyone, from seasoned scholars to new believers. This is the life of Christ illuminated like you've never experienced before. When you order this incredible collection, you'll also receive the new Best of Defender Publishing ebook collection on DataDisc. Now, for the first time, this must-have assortment features 120 of the most information-packed best-selling books in Defender history, including the never-before-digitally released version of the Defender Family Bible, featuring Old and New Testament with expanded Apocrypha. These full-length works are in popular ebook formats, so you can read them on Kindle, EPUB, PDF, and other handheld electronic devices. Give this collection as the ultimate gift to somebody you know this holiday season, or take them with you wherever you go. Valued at over $2,000 all by itself. But that's not all. With the holidays just around the corner, now's your chance to save big and receive bonus merchandise. As included in the Mystery of Jesus grand giveaway are any number of brand new super quality overstock gift books, DVDs, or audio sets to add to your library or give away as gifts this coming holiday season. Sold separately, these items hold a retail value of over $2,000. Yours now for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. This is the largest giveaway of the year, just in time for the holiday gift giving season, and is available only while supplies last. So don't delay. The Mystery of Jesus Grand Giveaway. Available now at SkyWatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
Welcome back. We are continuing our discussion on the New Testament and how the Jews were waiting for a savior. They were waiting for a warrior, not just a savior, but somebody to come in and save them from the confines of Rome. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned earlier, though, the triumphal entry. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so on Palm Sunday, we all, you know, sing songs about blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. You know, the thing is that when Jesus rode in on a donkey, he was fulfilling Zechariah 9:9, the prophecy that said that the Messiah would ride in on a donkey to enter in the kingdom of God. The thing is, though, that the precedent for this entry was actually started back in the day of King David. Bathsheba and the prophet Nathan went to David and said, hey, Adonijah's trying to steal the throne, and God's already said that Solomon's going to be king. Right. What are we going to do with this?
Yeah.
Right.
David said, take him out to Gihon, and in that place, anoint him king. Then have him ride my personal donkey into Jerusalem to announce the arrival of the king.
Okay.
So they take him out to Gihon. They anoint him king. He's proclaimed king. He's king now. Too bad, Adonijah. You weren't in the right place at the right time.
Okay.
And that's how Adonijah found out that he wasn't the king. Okay. He was followed by an entourage of people that was so loud that at the beginning, Adonijah and his group were like, are we under attack? What's going on? What is this noise? What's this clamor I hear? So the thing is, you have to understand that the Sanhedrin was waiting for the repeat of that entry to show that the Messiah was there. Rome was watching for it as well.
Yeah.
So Jesus goes and he comes riding in and all the people on the streets are waving leaves at him and laying leaves on the ground before him and saying, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Yeah. Basically, everybody who's singing, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, these people are wigging these people out. He's either so blasphemous he's claiming to be the Messiah, or he really is the Messiah.
Right.
Either way, this guy is a problem because he hasn't overthrown Rome.
Right.
So if he hasn't overthrown Rome, can't be the Messiah.
Yeah. All the things haven't happened. Yep.
And now he's got to die. And he's getting the people shaken up. We don't want another uproar.
Yeah.
We don't want more people we have to crucify or sell into slavery, right?
Right.
So we gotta squelch this right away. And symbolically, when there was a defeat in war, the returning conquering king or the new one that just conquered and surprise, you're being taken over, you know, he would come riding into the city. If they did not celebrate and, yay, we're with you, we're part of your entourage,
they
were executed.
Yeah,
because a lot of times this victorious king would come with the captives in tow.
Mm-hmm.
So if you weren't with this guy, you got to get executed publicly by... That's right. So this is a show of loyalty. Where is the crowd in all of this? Mm-hmm. And so the crowd's response was one of the final nails in that coffin where Rome is like, something's got to happen. And that's actually why they conspired together to crucify Jesus.
Wow. That is very, very interesting. I love history.
And I wish I had more time to talk about Pilate, but let me tell you this. There's this one moment in the Bible that we skim over in church. Mm-hmm. And that's when Pilate says, "Shall I crucify your king? Yeah. Is this Jesus, King of the Jews?" Well, let me explain mm-hmm. that sign they put on him, it was written in three different languages. So that all that multicultural population in Sepphoris would understand, this is what happens if you think you're Messiah or the new king of Rome or basically the new anything important.
Right.
This is what happens to you. We don't understand because of the cultural language barrier.
Right.
But when he was saying, "Shall I crucify your king?" Basically, he was saying, remember your friends. Remember your neighbors.
Yep.
Remember all the 32,000 plus people you haven't seen again.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Who's with this guy?
Right. Oh,
claim him as your king because you're next.
Choose wisely.
And everybody stands there. And the answer is, "We have no king but Caesar. Crucify him." Mm-hmm. It's just too risky to back him. Who is he? He hasn't overthrown Rome. They couldn't get over that one thing.
Right.
You know, and there were three kinds of people in the crowd that day. There were the kind who were within Roman politics and knew he had to go. There were the kind within religious politics and knew he had to go. Yeah. And then there were other people who, wherever they stood, they were just too scared to stand with him.
Wow. Yeah. And here's the thing. At the time of Christ, what was legally allowed to happen in the court of law for the Sanhedrin, his trial was so illegal on so many levels.
Wow.
He was not executed. He was murdered. But here's the fun thing. If he had not have died the criminal's death, his blood would not have purchased our redemption.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if he hadn't died at all, or he would have been able to get out of it. You know what I'm saying? Like everything culminated into this thing where he was a criminal, but he wasn't a criminal. Mm-hmm. And he was executed, but he was really murdered. It's this thing that only God could orchestrate.
Yeah.
See, he did something that the other would-be messiahs of the day didn't do. Mm. He came back.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, to those who understood and walked with him, it washed away every single doubt.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, you look at these case for Christ type studies, you realize these apostles had absolutely no reason to go through the torture that they went through. The deaths that these men faced were horrific.
Horrific.
Okay. They put Quentin Tarantino, just a completely different category. These guys went through torture that is unfathomable. Did they do that so that we would all read about what they wrote about and make them famous? Like, there's a reason that they met their own death, willing to take that level of truth all the way to the Gospels.
Right. Yeah.
He is who he said he was.
Mm-hmm. To the ends of the earth.
Yeah.
And that is happening. You had mentioned he said, well, it'll fizzle out if he's not real. But if he is real,
he is.
And we're talking about it today, Jesus is just as much alive today as he ever has been. He lives in each one of us. Please join us next week as we'll round out this whole series. It's just been such a very amazing,
eye-opening
series. Yeah, please join us next week in the Simply His Coffee Shop.